Hello, good people. Before our conversation with Jordan Hall, I would like to bring attention to our fall courses at Parallax Academy. If you are interested in the best and most provocative thinkers of the day and are looking for a community of adventurers, please join one of our four-week courses, which are guaranteed to give you intellectual and spiritual nourishment and adventure, and might even change your life. Starting in November, the philosophical power couple, O.G. Rose, will take us on a journey called Look at the Birds of the Air, How We Must Unplan Our Lives, which begins Saturday, November 4th. Get your tickets while there is still space, or check out our growing library of courses in the links below. And now, prepare to have your mind blown completely by a conversation with the amazing Jordan Hall. So welcome, Jordan Hall, to Parallax. I've been reading Ivan Illich for many, many years, and we have a series at Parallax called Tools for Conviviality. I remember, and I don't know where, I remember you mentioning this term. So this term kind of came to me from you, and I was like, oh, Jordan and Jordan's ideas, there's a link to Ivan Illich somewhere, and I'm curious about that. So perhaps we can begin there.
Yeah, I'm trying to even remember. Probably 2006, I'm guessing. So we're after, let's say, my Deleuze phase. Mm-hmm. Well after my Marshall McLuhan phase, but very much in the build out into what ultimately became Game B. So the kind of Illich. Now that I think about it, actually. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin happened to be roughly contemporary in my sort of reading. But it was quite beautiful. I was actually handed the book by somebody who said, you'll like this. He sounds like you. And I actually really did. I would even say like love. There's a warmth. It's weird. Like the feeling to me is almost like wood. It's an earthiness, but like a coziness and a naturalness and something like a rightness or a wholesomeness to the tone, like where he's coming from, and even the way he thinks about it. It's such a beautiful pre-digital mind.
Pre-digital, and you said he sort of feels like he lived in the 12th century, that is his natural home. So that's really that's really pre-digital. Yeah, you said, wow, I'm a guy from the 12th century.
Yeah,
I don't belong here.
Pre-literate, right? Pre-printing press mind. Yeah, that's beautiful. That feeling. It definitely feels like a connection to a completely, fully realized, like fully lived, but very different, deeply, fundamentally different mindset that has a more connectedness to it, more liveness, which makes sense, right? Talk about those kinds of ideas. And I was actually originally focused on it from the point of view of education. Can't remember the book right now. Perhaps you know it.
De-schooling Society.
De-schooling. Exactly. Perfect. Right? De-schooling Society, which I effectively chapter and verse, like, yes, correct. This is it. His critique is correct, and his suggestion gestures mostly in the right direction. I would say that I was deeply influenced both spiritually and intellectually by his approach and, frankly, many of his ideas. We just kind of roll into it. Then the question might be something like, okay, how does that fit into something like Civium?
Yeah, that is the question, yeah.
And what I notice is, you know, it's one of these beautiful things where in no way explicitly, like I haven't gone back and sort of reread Illich and said, okay, how does that apply? But in a very deep way, implicitly, you know, so there's a substantial orientation towards rethinking all the different modalities of how we use technology, for example, which I include organizational structures as a subset of that, to create the world that creates us. Yeah. I think actually in De-schooling Society, he had a conversation around a new way of doing cars. He's specifically saying, hey, we can intercept this idea in South America before it just sort of maps and replicates the North American approach. And here's a whole different conception. And that level of like, hey, let's think about what does it look like to build cars that are easy to fix, like super, super easy to fix, and cars that are resilient to roads. So we don't have to pave everything to a very high level, but we can actually think differently about it. Now, my current sensibility, this is more intuitive, is more oriented towards the new possibilities of what's emerging. I don't know if you read the essay that I released recently, but
yeah, I did.
The fourth industrial revolution, as our friends in Davos have chosen to brand it, from my point of view, do hold within them a very large number of capacities, which, if we choose to design them in this way, naturally orient towards a much more distributed and much more local, let's say, economy, for example, and society for that matter. Less so about retooling, but obviously there's no reason why we wouldn't. You know, it would be beautiful to start thinking about how we could, in some sense, maybe use these new techniques and these new technologies, but then also think about how we can then, I'll give you an idea in a moment of what I'm thinking about more concretely, but use these to change the kind of the economic constraints that lock certain technical solutions in the present environment in, so we can use a new technology. Let's say, for example, just as a hypothetical, let's say we were to find that with new technology, precision fermentation, we could radically produce biodiesel at a much lower price and a much higher velocity. So then we can start sort of importing biodiesel vehicles from Brazil, but we could actually change the fueling infrastructure. Instead of fueling infrastructure being tied to gas stations, we could actually have biodiesel farm stands that were providing a different approach to how we fuel vehicles, right? So you change the economics of a particular thing, biodiesel, which has existed for a long time. Oh, wow, now I'm starting to go off. There's a whole other idea that popped into my head, but wasn't economically or technically available just yet. But if you change the underlying technological premise, you can change the economic constraints, which then perhaps move it into the point of viability, which then allow us to retool around a different infrastructural approach. The other one that just popped into my mind actually is some friends of mine, and I think I'm formerly an advisor to their company, have taken the material technology of bioceramic. You familiar with this?
Nope.
So bioceramic was initially developed for things like teeth and bones and joints and things like that. So it's a ceramic, right? It's a non-organic material, but it's highly biocompatible. It has all kinds of good characteristics, like being really strong and really light and completely non-toxic. You can put it in your body. So these guys have used that raw kind of idea, the technology and the material, but they've produced a form of bioceramic that can be used in construction, like for building buildings. And they've actually glued that together in much of the approach that I just mentioned. So they've noticed that by unlocking this new material technology, bioceramic is completely fireproof or extremely high fire resistant. I don't want to throw it at the sun and see if it survives. Again, very lightweight, but actually is very strong in relationship to, say, concrete, both in terms of rotational, much stronger this way, and also compression, as well as the ordinary sort of holding strength, pulling, twisting, compressing, like lots, like thousands of times stronger. And maybe we say a tenth as heavy, and actually much faster to produce. You can make precision molding it. And again, non-toxic, no toxic grams at all. It's actually carbon negative. So that's all really good, right? But then the next thing that they immediately jump to is that this also unlocks the ability to go back and start building domes, right? So much like biodiesel, we have an idea that had almost like a spiritual moment in the 60s and 70s, very Buckminster Fuller, but the material science at the time couldn't actually build a livable, hospitable dome in any economically viable way. Concrete was too heavy. You know, we ended up with kind of like vinyl, which wasn't really a home, that kind of thing. But with bioceramic, not only couldn't you totally build really amazing domes, by the way, at a much lower cost than existing houses cost. It's like economically like half as expensive as an existing house. faster than existing houses, and with a very large fraction of both the materials and the production of the parts, hyper-local. So it's a huge state shift. And of course, all of that sounds very Scythian, right? Those different characteristics. So that's, to me, like that notion of being able to combine new techniques that change the state of affairs, like the system dynamics, the economics, even the material possibilities of maybe approaches that we've looked at many times in history. Mm-hmm. And, by the way, create entirely new ones. Don't throw that baby out with the bathwater. But consciously thinking, how do we do this very much within the mindset of tools for conviviality? And how do we think about this from the point of view of human need and human use, in the most humane way?
Yeah, because the utopian potential of, you know, we know there's utopian potentials out there, right? In a sense. But then there's the human, then there's the human nature and how human nature is, which is why I think we need to look at the sort of, why it's so important to balance that with a real spiritual or religious or, you know, dimension.
Yeah, we'll get there in a moment.
Okay. I was wondering if you were moving towards that a little bit. Yeah.
I can't help it naturally. Yeah, but we had, for those who are watching, we had a little brief conversation, and you mentioned the religious, so that's definitely in the back of my mind. But let me actually quickly, something that I've always liked to play with, and I'm weird, so I imagine nobody else does, but you know, utopian, the Greek, right? Utopos, which is the no place, that the place that isn't.
Yeah.
I've always heard otopian, EU, which is the good place. And I simply say, yes, Scythium is the otopian, not the utopian vision. And this is the fact that we can make better places. And in fact, consistently endeavor to do so. And sometimes we get caught up in things that satisfy our desires, but don't actually, but aren't actually right for us. Much of the modern city is that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, we can consciously put our thumb on the scale and start bending our ontological design in an utopian direction.
Okay. It's interesting because as you were speaking again, I think a lot about religion. I think the notion of the city on the hill or whatever, which is so deep in the theology, you know, of the West, and it's still a city, but it's probably not a city in the same sense that we think of a city today. So I imagine the city on the hill is a bit like Scythium in the sense that it is a good place, but it's also not centralized either. So that's interesting.
Well, to use the religious language, it's a very specific form of centralized that is not subject to the kinds of capture that we're normally used to, because it's centered on the divine or on the transcendent,
yeah,
which is really the best place to put a center, and then that allows us to decenter the parts that are subject to ordinary human capture.
Okay.
And we've moved quite deeply into a religious context, but I think we might as well. What path, what direction do you want to take on that front? There's so many different ways of diving into this.
Well, that just really intrigues me, the idea that there has to be a central notion, a central principle. And then also there has to be a way to dissolve what is not in line with that center without reverting to some kind of totalitarian systemization. Yeah. And I think that Illich's work was very interesting in the sense that he saw the corruption of Christianity in a sense as being this sort of institutionalized corruption, centralized corruption, and he was calling for something else. You know, he called it, I think he said, restoring the art of living.
Funny, because that's actually very specifically the language that Christ used. Yeah. Life. What I'm bringing you into is life.
Yes.
It seems like the Pharisee instinct has a repetitive pattern, that notion of becoming overly indexed on the formalisms, overly indexed on the legalisms, and of course, seduced by the power and the wealth and status that comes from connecting yourself to the institutions. Obviously, that's part of human nature. And we see that all over the place. All over the place. Yeah. So one of the things that I was introduced to a couple of years ago that I was quite enlightening for me I can't vouch that this is true. I've only heard it, but I like it, so I'll just repeat it. That the early Greek city-states, let's say Athens as an example, were governed in a fashion closer to Quakers than to our sense of democracy. Mm-hmm. And this is what I mean by that. There was a very distinct sense that the civic, the civitas, in this case, Athena, was itself an actual being. And that the citizens of mm-hmm. Athens were in service to, and in some sense, subordinate to that being. Yeah. So your job in governance was to discern what Athens wanted, not to horse trade between what the Athenians wanted. And so we call politics, which is horse trading between power blocks, is a lost or a fallen sense of what this looks like. And of course, my understanding, at least, is of the Quakers, is they make a distinction between a gathered meeting and just a regular old profane meeting, where if the presence of God is in the meeting, it is a gathered meeting. And our job is to discern and speak the divine into the space, which then is actually able to engage in true sovereignty, true governance.
Yeah.
If for whatever reason, the presence is not here, then we're just ordinary human beings and we can do logistics, but we can't actually do anything true governance. That part of the notion.
I was thinking as you were speaking that you know, I live near Paris, and Paris has a being, you know, and definitely has a being already. Like, even if there isn't a formal sense of, you know, people getting together and protecting the spirit of Paris, like there's one, I think it's, I can't remember, there's one saint on one of the bridges, which is the patron saint of Paris. And so people used to think that way.
And in some sense, you can, it's not, we can flip back and forth between different paradigmatic modes. It's easy in some sense, even just as a child, to know when the spirit of a place has been profaned or violated. Mm-hmm. To use a very simple example, if you have, if you were to go to Yosemite Park and cut down the sequoias, you've clearly profaned the spirit of the place. Like this would be obvious to anybody who is not themselves a sociopath. And that same sensibility is true kind of anywhere. And if you really are in connection, say in communion with the vibe of a place, then the place has a vibe, right? And you can tell. What does it mean to be participating earnestly? Oh, funny, I'm feeling Andy Johar's stuff back here. What does it mean to be participating earnestly or with integrity with a place? And what does it mean to be violating the sense of that place's place? And I began to really think about this from the lens of maturity. One of the characteristics of Civium that I've noticed is, in comparison to, say, the city as I've characterized it, obviously there's a lot of nuance that we're talking about, a giant concept, but the city as I've characterized it is that the city is ultimately dominated by an immature, in some sense, even an adolescent sensibility. It's driven by the super salient, right? It's driven by the visceral, right? Fast pace, right? The hit, the cutting edge culture. It's very fashionable. It's very oriented towards, like, makes it a superficial status. And that's very much the essence, really, of city. Like, it has that vibe to it. And it's very attractive to that mentality. Right? When you're 20, you want to leave the small town and go to the city because that's where things are happening, right? Where you can be part of the scene, right? And you can become somebody. And certainly all those things where that's the element, like if in the creative arts where fame is a currency, the city's the place to go. By the way, the creative arts where actually creating art is the thing, the city can steal your soul in a big way, right? Very famously, right? Everybody who is, not everybody, but many, many stories of truly great artists who are actually doing art, then they get caught up in the vibe of the city and they get, they themselves get profane.
Isn't there a way that they also need the city though? Like they come from the province and they learn something in the city and then they leave again. Like it's almost like an underworld journey like Rimbaud came from the province. He didn't, many of the great artists don't actually come from the city. They come from outside the city. They come from somewhere wild.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is, you know, if you think about the way that I was pointing it out in my essay, you need to be in connection with other people, right? You need to the way you come from the province where you have connection with nature, with God and with yourself, right? Because it gives you the ability to be an artist in a deep way. Then you go to the city where you meet other artists, right? Who are doing other things. There's all this capacity for technique and new perspectives and color creative collaboration that you couldn't get in the province. Right? So that was true, by the way. And the point that I'm making in that essay is that it's decreasingly true as what we're doing, right? We're not in the same city. You and I are engaging in creative collaboration means of a Zoom call.
Yeah.
And that's just going to get richer and richer and richer. And so that need for connecting with other people, this new place, the virtual, right, that aspect of the civium that is virtual, in many ways, and maybe completely, but certainly in many ways, will replace the city as the center of where you go to access that resource.
Yeah. I mean, even I live in not my own home country, so you don't even have to live in your home country anymore, in a sense. And I moved outside of the city. So there's a way in which, the social life, this larger social life and meeting people who have the same interests and feel and, you know, as you do, is quite easy. So there's enough social life that there's no need to kind of go out there and look for it
This goes back to that theme of maturity. That grown-ups, adults, take responsibility for their place, which is very hard to do in the city, but they also are very mindful of the what kind of context supports the growth of family, young people coming up.
Yeah.
What kind of place is conducive to elderhood? And by elderhood, I don't mean just dying. What I mean is participating and contributing lived wisdom to a community. And by the way, they're also connected to memory, right? And the city doesn't really have memory, whereas place has memory, right? So I really do have a strong sense that as we're moving, certainly in the West, but as we're moving through what I think is fundamentally been an adolescent phase into a phase which is beginning to be governed more by the values of maturity, we'll be rediscovering that place and intimate relationship with place, which by the way also means intimate relationship with the other people who have intimate relationship with that place, satisfies a whole multitude of values that are more fundamental values than the values that the more adolescent values that are available in the city as such. Now that starts to bring us, I think, also back into religion in a very deep way, because I would say that we can speak about the transcendent aspect of religion, which we should, but we can also speak about the immanent aspect of religion. And that's what we were, in some sense, we were just treading in that territory.
Yes.
Of birth, right? Where children are born and where the field of nature and ontological place and community and relationships is deeply, deeply oriented towards supporting the best possible context for where children are born and where children are raised, which implies continuity. You know, the best place for children to be born and raised is also the best place, is the place where elders elder, and they hold the community to its deeper values, and they understand how to apply wisdom with stewardship to other people, to relationships, and to place, right? So all these things are linked together. And at the embodied level, at the incarnate level, a lot of that, let me see if we can do this, is at the heart, I would say, of all religions. Obviously, right?
Well, I have one example I was thinking about when you're talking, because I brought up Paris. Paris was a small town at one point, and this tiny little town built Notre Dame Cathedral, together. Like it was like 10,000 people.
Wow, I did not know that.
It
That
was
is
just a little
amazing.
town, and they all built the town together. So that's a different thing than what Paris is now, and almost just it's just a remnant of that. People go there to feel the resonance of what that once was.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yes, if you can get yourself into the felt sense of a town of 10,000 people building Notre Dame together, then you're in the space that I'm proposing. And a return to that sensibility. And that's the sense is that we're liberated from this incredibly powerful attractor of the city as the place that has superlinear scaling and innovation and wealth. The virtual is liberating for us from that. It's creating its own trouble, but it's breaking that. And so now, set free, we're now on a new trajectory. There's a lot of momentum. And I don't know, by the way, I haven't done a deep, deep analysis of all the other drivers and attractors that are present in the city. And this doesn't mean that they will all go away. There may still be a lot of stuff that's hanging on that will keep more dense urban environments. The more fundamental elements of the divine place and human life from birth to death, and all the community and all those sort of things that happen in rich, real relationships through that arc, those are more fundamental, like radically more fundamental. I propose, I suspect, and I hope, let's say, we'll re be able to be reestablished now that this dominating power of the superlinear scaling of dense urban environments is beginning to give loosen its grip.
Well, what about that's I mean that's wonderful, that's beautiful. And but I also have the image of Notre Dame burning and collapsing and this whole apocalyptic thing. Ivan Illich talks about
Yeah.
wasn't very he wasn't very like he saw a big apocalypse coming. An apocalypse in the sense of everything becoming revealed and a lot of trouble. Are you feeling, I mean, that's kind of a silly
Yeah.
question because I think
No, I see a
everybody
big
keeps
apocalypse
saying there's
coming
this
too.
meta crisis and then everything is, Daniel Schmachtenberger, et cetera. I keep hearing people talk about how bad it's going to get. You're not really talking that way. So that's kind of interesting.
How bad is it's going to get very bad. There we go.
Yeah, exactly. So,
No question. Although, let's say, I actually have kind of wanted to write an essay on this. Let me just kind of drop it here. Let me think. Okay. If you don't remind me about the notion of revelation here. I think coming back to that could be really good, but let me just do Graeber for a second. Actually, interestingly enough, around the same time that I was reading Illich, I was also reading David Graeber. And in the story of, I think it's 1,000 years of none of debt, first 5,000 years, something like that, some long period of time debt. He doesn't really expand on this, but he points something out that I found very interesting, which was that there appears to be reasons, there appears to be cycles in how money operates. And there appears to be a govern, like the reason for these cycles that is locked into the nature of, say, money and humans or some combination. And what I have read into it is something like a wave, like a sine wave, that has a materialist arc and a spiritual arc. And then what happens is that, for example, as you begin to reach the peak of the materialist arc in culture, you also are reaching the point where money is getting maximally debased. Counterfeit, inflation, that
So
kind of thing.
money loses its spiritual essence or something like that.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. Like it starts out with this, with its spiritual essence is grounded in human relationships, like lived vital communities. It takes advantage of the ability to decontextualize and therefore connect larger and larger groups, but with less and less real relationship, which produces certain material advantages, significant and real. Right? So this begins to move us in the upcycle of the materialist arc. So we start to accumulate material, but at the cost of beginning to move us away from the spiritual center. And we enter into a bargain. You can identify which particular demon is the one, maybe it's Mammon, where we begin to feed our spiritual lack with material abundance. Oh, I'm missing relationships, but I can buy better stuff. I can have a better house, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
At the individual and at the civilization level. And I'm imagining Rome right now, because that's the meme.
Well, I mean, here we're like Rome, aren't we? I mean, we have so much wealth, like just an incredible amount of wealth that's unimaginable, kind of. And yet
we're hollow, right?
Yeah, we're empty and we're ciphers. I'm using Ivan Illich's words again. He talked about this becoming ciphers, becoming empty, becoming, you know, virtual.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look around, like if you just say, okay, let me run this clock back just 10 years and watch what's happened in just the last decade, much less the last 50 years.
Yeah.
It's a pretty solid pattern. Yeah. You know? And fascinatingly, Graeber points out that as the currency is debased, and there's lots of other characteristics, but it's a really nice one, that you get a collapse, right? As a currency gets to the point where people stop having faith in the symbol, in the currency, then the currency collapses. And this then is tied to a fragility at the material level, which begins to produce a material collapse, a generalized material collapse. Now here, by the way, I can bridge from Graeber over to, what's his name? Tainter. There's almost certainly a connection there, that the hyper-materialized culture is also hyper-fragile, right? It is in fact hollow. And so at a certain point, once it reaches a critical perturbation, it begins a generalized systemic collapse at the material level. But here's the good news. Historically, that pattern also tends to then begin the initiation of restoration of the spiritual. You know, the collapse of the Bronze Age leads to the Axial Age. The collapse of the Classical Age leads to the Christian era, right? Those kinds of things. And so this would imply that our presence, right, the proximity of a material metacrisis and the meaning crisis, which is a spiritual nadir, may be putting us forth to a collapse that is akin to that. Meaning, for example, our fiat monetary system collapses, which precipitates a generalized, what would you call that? Preference. What's that called? There's a term that when people sort of own up to what they already believe. So there's preference falsification and preference realization or something over here. So propose, for example, that everybody already knows that our state is hollow. Everybody already knows that the institutions are a bad combination.
Yeah, like that Leonard Cohen song, everybody knows, everybody knows.
Everybody knows.
Yeah.
But nobody's willing to actually sign up for that formally. So we're all kind of like play acting that we actually live in a non-hollow state. But when just the right pinprick hits, money being the easiest one, because at the end of the day, once money doesn't actually get the ability for me to stuff my spiritual, the hole in my heart with material excess, well then fuck that, right? If I can't actually buy the stuff that satisfies my needs, then I'm hitting rock bottom at a certain level, and I'm beginning to have to return to actually doing the spiritual thing directly. And there's an advantage to that. There's an advantage to actually losing your ability to buy cocaine. I mean, you have to kick the habit. You can't do it anymore.
It's a painful business, right?
No, it ain't good. There are better ways, right? There are better ways. It's always better to not get addicted, and always better to quit your addiction now.
Yeah.
But if it takes rock bottom, it takes rock bottom. And so that's the way I look at it, right? My sense is, yes, we're in a metacrisis. My sense is that this metacrisis is profound. Right? It's a very big kind of thing. It's all consuming it in every direction. It's a psychological, paradigmatic mindset. Every single system and everywhere in the world, more or less. And we're reaching the end of that phase. And part of that end is that we're reaching the end of a massive, massive materialist cycle, which then, interestingly enough, if this theory is vaguely correct, means that we're entering into the beginning of a massive spiritual cycle.
So Jordan, I don't mean to ask a personal question, but as you were speaking, I was thinking about how you used to work in tech and did all these things and made a bunch of money and then you didn't go the way of many other people in your realm might go. in a sense. And when we met in Vermont, you said something that I've been thinking about. You said that you were trying to avoid religion your whole life, and then you've come to the conclusion that this is what needs to be. You know, we need religion.
Yeah, we need religion.
I thought that was a very interesting thing, and I kind of feel the same way, and I kind of feel that. I kind of, the word faith, which you also just mentioned a moment ago, is something that I've been thinking about, what it means to be a person of faith, which, you know, not many people were thinking about in the 90s or the 2000s.
Many more are thinking about now.
Yeah, yeah. And many more are thinking about now, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, if we could do such a thing, which, by the way, somebody like Google probably could, we could trace the sentiment of faith, like just the curiosity about it, and the sentiment of like the debasement of fiat currency is two different vectors. And I'm like 99% sure that faith is doing that and fiat currency is doing that. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So where were you going? Like you floated out the notion that I got off the tech billionaire train. Like I had a ticket. I had a ticket on the tech billionaire train.
Yeah.
I didn't get on that train.
And you didn't get on that train. Why not? And what happened? And what?
I guess it's.
I mean, I consider you to be very lucky to have not gotten that train, you know.
But I would say it in two ways. Let me say it in sort of a more secular way, and then more of a spiritual way. In the psychological secular way, what I noticed is that I was unimpressed. I did dip my toe. I spent probably about a good 18 months to 2 years kind of being rich and spending time with rich folks doing rich folk stuff. Like legit, like billionaire rich, not me personally, but with others, flying private jets to private islands and hanging out with powerful people in fancy places.
Yeah.
And I just noticed that I was not impressed. Like I had a felt sense of like, is that all there is? That's not that interesting. I suppose in some sense, I was a little bit saved by sheer, you know, liking philosophy and intellectual conversations. Because those aren't really available. So it's a different currency.
Yep.
And also, I think a little bit saved by the fact that I was always very much grounded in a kind of a lower middle class, even kind of rural Texas sensibility. And so the affectations of the highly urban wealthy, well, were always a little off-putting. And I can kind of see
could see through it a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, see through it a bit, yeah. Or at least it didn't appeal it. I had a built-in aversion to it, which was strong enough to help me be like, oh yeah. And I can see that the glitter is guilt. There's a reason why it's called the Gilded Age. At a spiritual level, what I would say is that I've actually had at least three occasions in my life where there was a fork in the road where the obvious smart thing to do would be to go left. And I knew how to go left. I don't want to go into too much detail, but the door was open, right? I could be on the train to be like in the direction of substantial material success. Notable, like the very laudable, notable things. And something in me, very much in spite of myself, right? Having nothing to do with my being smart or clever, like something in me jerked me onto the right-hand path, like forcibly, in a way that made me feel like I had failed. Like I had undermined myself, but in maybe every decade. So each time that I've noticed by looking back, like, wow, I kind of lucked out. I don't know why, but I was sort of saved by something from.
You were saved by failing. That's interesting.
Saved by failing. Yeah. And failing always, by the way, at the last second, right? Very much like the ticket was punched. The door was open. My foot was on the threshold and then yanked out of it. So you can figure out how you'd like to tell that story, but that's kind of it. And that's what it was. So a combination of having, you know, Texas rural middle-class values and aesthetics, being unimpressed. And by the way, it's not very impressive. You know, the world, the glittery world of of what's that Met Gala? And that thing is not. I would have no interest in going.
I know what that is, but
oh, check it out. Just take a look at it. Particularly over the last few years, it's becoming sort of increasingly absurd. You know the movie Hunger Games. I thought did a very good job. Like really, I thought it was beautifully done.
Yeah, I've been around rich people a very small amount, and what I saw actually was like a glittery heaven that was actually hell.
Yeah,
like they were doing cocaine and dying and inside like in this sort of glitzy sort of Riviera on the south of France, and I felt, oh God, this is not actually the paradise. This looks like paradise on the outside, but it's very dark here.
And you know, if I could find a way to convey to those very people the wealth that I have now, living in a place with people who, with neighbors who I care about and who care about me, and who care about the place we live, and who care about, we care about each other's children, which is just a ordinary community.
Yeah.
Ordinary, wholesome community. I would absolutely 10 times out of 10, 1,000 times out of 1,000 trade this for private jets and private islands. Like it's not even quasi close.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I count myself extraordinarily fortunate to have been brought into this context. And to a level that very much connects me to a religious sensibility. And it's the kind of thing where I definitely did not get here on the basis of me being clever. I did not get here because I figured it out.
Well, isn't that a classic religious thing? I mean, you're obviously clever, but it happens out of grace or something usually. And why it happens is utterly mysterious, and nobody knows why somebody gets on that train and other people get on this train or whatever.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the answer people ask me, like, well, you know, it's just, yeah, you have to figure out exactly why are you here? Why are you in this place? Like, look, the best answer I can give is the divine hand brought me here. Like if I wanted to go back and kind of create a causal linkage that gets us here, I can fabricate. I can tell a story, and the story is true. Like it's an accurate story. Definitely not like causal in a deep sense. Like it's very, very not superficial. It could have been anywhere. It would have led to the same place, but it's not here. This is a good spot. So, yeah. Thank you, God, for putting me in this spot after a long time. Like I've been around for a while. So let's see. Yeah. So the religion, we can speak at the immanent level.
Mm-hmm.
And there, I think it's very critical. Like we could spend hours if you'd like, and I can say, sort of defend, diagnose, and explain what religion is at the immanent level and why it's obviously necessary for any actually thriving human existence. Right? That's just, we can spend time there, but I don't have any trouble arguing that.
Is this the religion that's not the religion, as I've heard you talk about with John?
Sure,
Or is it religion? And do we have to say the religion that's not the religion? Are we at a point now where we can just talk about wholesome religion, or do we have to still say it's not a religion?
That's great. That's a great question. I would say that the transcendent, the connection between the immanent and the transcendent, and the relationship with of course, we call the omniscient, but in this case, we could just say, for example, the institutional, or the doxa, the dogma, the language, the story, the narrative, the ideology. It's useful to still be careful. And so there's sine qua non, right? There's no way that you don't do wholesome religion in the imminent, like in the lived. Again, I totally agree with you there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I have enough background that I can actually also defend that if somebody wanted to dig into it. Okay. Yeah. Second, now we've talked about this. There seems to be some problem with the institutional level. Like institutions seem to have a characteristic of, institutions, by the very nature of institutions, regardless of whether they're the Department of Defense or the State Department or GM, have a senescence built in. Human institutions grow old and die. Ideally die. Sometimes they grow old and become zombies. Many times they do. And so to the degree to which your religion ultimately becomes its institutional structure, it's going to get stuck in that problem. Right? The human piece of it will grow old and die, or grow old and become undead, and then you're in deep trouble. Okay, so then we have the transcendent. Right? And this is where I think when John speaks about the religion that's not a religion, the religion part is the immanent. The not a religion part is largely this institutional issue. But then the transcendent's a bit of a sticking point. And this is where I think he's really working with the extended transcendent naturalism to sort of glue these pieces together. Mm-hmm. Because the obvious answer to the aforementioned institutional senescence problem is that the center is in fact the divine. And the center isn't the institution. The center is God in the Western mm-hmm. Hebrew monotheistic sensibilities.
Yeah.
Or even in Hinduism, the center would still be God, just God's, perhaps very particular God. And what does that mean, right? This is like a key thing. This is a real challenge. Like, how do we actually find a way to allow ourselves to be governed by the transcendent in support of the lived reality of the immanent? And then with some kind of institutional structure that ultimately is playing was functionally a logistical role, right?
Yeah. Not
a
governance role. Yeah.
Weirdly, the same thing shows up in the context of AI. If you'd like to, if you don't mind me jumping there real quick.
Yeah, I just had one really awesome, again, connection to Illich, because Illich says that he was supporting the church that was she and not the church that was it. So I thought, that, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that, good. That's, I think, in a way what you're saying. Maybe not exactly, but.
Yeah, that's very nice, because the point to me, the way I hear that is aliveness and relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And even something like tenderness. Yeah.
Yeah.
Qualities of relationship,
mm-hmm.
a close relationship, intimate relationship. And I totally get that. You know, when you're, when I go to church, what I feel is the intimacy of relationship, right? That's the centerpiece of it. The sense of connectedness, by the way, vertical, transcendent sense, mm-hmm. and then also horizontal, the sense of care for each other. And by the way, for the place that we're in. And then the building, right? And then the logistics are scaffold. They're really irreducible, by the way, irreducible support structure. But they're not God, and they're not the church in the sense of the community. Yeah. And as soon as they take themselves as such, then that's when you're in trouble. And I would say that that's when they've kind of disconnected themselves, and it starts to feel like an it. Mm-hmm. It feels like an object that is out there, and oftentimes a powerful object over which I have very little influence. Yeah, that's nice. I like that. That's a very kind of very humane way of making the point. And the more humane in this case, the better.
Well, you know, Illich has this whole thing about that sort of the institutionalization of care, which actually removes you from care,
mm-hmm.
right? And that was really what he wanted to talk about, and how churches over time, the corruption of the best became the worst. Again, mm-hmm. I'm just quoting him here, but that, yeah,
yeah, yeah. I think this is a recurring problem. I think I've talked about this in other contexts. And this is definitely, I think maybe I talked about it in the podcast with Jim Rutt on the religion is not a religion.
Mm.
Like we can step back actually and say, okay, it's not about, let's say the church, like the medieval church. It's not about the medieval church per se. It's about human institutions in general. So it doesn't matter whether you're talking about the World Health Organization, which is a wildly fucked up institution right now, or yep. the FBI, right? Or yep. the DOD. Or this, mm-hmm. fill in the blank. Like
but again, sorry to interrupt, but Illich connects that to the Christian church because he thinks this is the origin of all the modern institutions and the origin of the corruption of modern institutions.
Oh, no, I disagree. I disagree.
Okay,
well, you disagree. I think it is of the essence of human institutions.
Okay.
All of them will always undergo the same exact process in exactly the same way that the human body goes through the process of dying. Right, there's a vitality of youth, there's a capacity of maturity, there's a senescence, and then there's a death. And yep. the problem is that human institutions don't necessarily die. human institutions live well beyond their natural life.
So it's all about learning how to die, in a sense, or how to let these temporary support structures fall away and the new thing to arise.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, and I don't mean, by the way, to, like, I'm actually feeling kind of the Orthodox Christians in the background, giving the opposite case, which is legitimate. There is, if we're able to stay guided by that which is eternal, which doesn't die by its nature, right? Nor is it born, it's eternal. Then that can be the thing that provides the art, right? The creative impulse to the ongoing process of birth and death that has to happen on the other side, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, they need to die and they need to be reborn. There's a continuous process of renewal, but they are not renewed by their own basis, right? They're renewed on the basis of that which is in fact the source of creation, not the thing that is created. And this is, I mean, it's so straightforward in some sense. Yeah. Even if I just put it in the very simple sense of an artist and the art, you know, Picasso had moods, right? He had periods. Picasso, as a creator, right, who had the capacity to create, had a birth and death phase. Like, he would move through a period, and that period would no longer be the period he was in. And as long as he was continuing to move along the arc of creation, the art is just what it was, right? The painting is the painting. It's a static object. It neither evolves nor dies. It just is there. It expresses a moment in time. It's a snapshot. And the movement, the period, like the blue period, if he somehow became addicted to the blue period and just kept on creating blue shit forever, that's obviously terrible. And you could very easily be able to identify the point at which it was dead, right? It's no longer connected to creative source. Mm-hmm. And he was like one of these terrible musicians who's kind of like playing their greatest hits from the 80s and no longer creative.
I think the creative process, there's a moment when it kind of blossoms, and that is like a gift, and then people hold on to that, and it becomes a simulacrum of that. And so you have the Rolling Stones playing the same old songs, you know, forever.
And that's, you know, and that's, I think that's a mapping. It's the same thing. An institution becoming a simulacrum of itself. In fact, Carol Quigley made a very specific distinction between an instrument and an institution. So for him, an instrument is in service to his purpose and connected to a vital principle. It's vital and vitally in service of his purpose. An institution is a simulacrum of itself. It's a simulacrum of an instrument. It looks like the same kind of thing, but it's dead. It's no longer vital, and it's no longer in service of its purpose. It's now in service of itself. Mm-hmm. Right? That's pretty clean. So we can be thoughtful about that. We can actually go to a higher level of abstraction or a larger perspective and say, okay, that happens. Fine. How do we now thoughtfully think about designing these new kind of these institutions, mindful of the fact that this will happen to them, mindful of what it looks like, and you know, when we're in these points where there's important decisions need to be made so we stay on the right track and we don't get captured by our own instrument into an institution. And then we'll be, I think, in a place where we can actually start thinking, saying the word religion without having to caveat it's not a religion.
Yeah. Well, I think there's this tension between like people who want to create something new. And there's a bit of a hubris in that without, you know, and then there's then the people who want to preserve the thing as it was. Mm-hmm. And both those are kind of wrong. I think there's a dance between the two or.
Yeah, this is to say again, what I think is if you're trying to preserve the thing as it was, orient yourself towards the aspects of that thing that are eternal.
Right. Because you're right to point out the eternal, let's say. I don't know. Jung would call them archetypes. I don't know what we can say is because there's I guess Platonic models, and then there's dynamic. Like one of the critiques of Platonic models is that they're static, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then I guess that the archetypes would have to be dynamic. They're the same archetypes, but they have a new quality with each iteration.
I mean, this is a fundamental and challenging question. It's tricky. I mean, you can't even really get your head around it ultimately, because if you're thinking about the notion of eternal, then you're also thinking about the notion of unchanging. But And it's easy to say, okay, whenever the eternal dips into the finite, or to use a slightly different language, or whenever the eternal dips into the temporal, it manifests in the way, in the fashion that it manifests in that moment. Right? So you perceive change in that direction, which Plato would be perfectly happy with that. But I think you're pointing to a deeper notion, is that the notion of change, the notion of aliveness, vitality, itself is an aspect of the eternal. I think Christianity
that's nicely put. Yeah,
Christianity, I think, taps into this quite nicely with the notion of the Trinity. And the Trinity is not Platonic. And the Trinity at its essence is relationship. And relationship at its essence has a dynamism to it. Relationship implies, you can't even say it. Right? The word relationship implies relationality. Relationality is not static. As soon as something is static, there's a instantaneous evaporation of all possibility of relationality. So at its core, right, the Trinity contains intrinsically, like no way around it, something about aliveness, something about, again, relationship, about connection, by the way, also. And so that, I think, is very much what you were pointing to, that movement from effectively is a mental construct, which snapshots things in an atemporal fashion, right? It can grasp things in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Analytic, right? It's an analytic snapshot, mm-hmm. separate, and a sort of more embodied, heart or spirit, which I think are roughly equivalent sensibilities, which grasps things in their actual connectedness, which, by the way, means also right now. Right? The eternal has this beautiful characteristic of right nowness. So by the way, in a minute, so this is certainly where I am, and I live the thing that I do. I don't sort of sit in an ivory tower and then imagine things but live differently. I endeavor very deeply to, my own theory tells me that you have to. So I live the thing that I do, and I'm living in this fashion. And I can say that the more deeply that I am able to steer into, what you call it, wholesome religion? Yeah.
I think I use the word wholesome, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like that. Wholesome religion, the more it reveals itself to me, the more I am actually discovering more and more about what it is this thing is. And the more obvious it is to me that that actually is the axis mundi of anything that humanity can ever actually, participate in that has, let's say, realness and something like endurance to it.
Mm-hmm. So how do you see, like, in the Civium? Uh-huh. So I guess taking apart that word civic, it's like it is almost like I'm imagining sort of overlapping congregations or something like this, or how does it work in terms of spiritual life for people? And I mean, is it different? How is it different than, and how is it the same as, whatever, a temple or a church or a synagogue?
Well, I mean, let's just be very pointed right now. We're now in what I sometimes call collaborative space. So the short answer is I have no idea.
Yeah.
So let's think about it. Let's just play with it. What might it look like? Well, first is that notion of the imminent or grounded. And so first it shows up in life, and it shows up in, I guess it's, I think, John, in the book of John. Are people actually really loving each other, right? Is it really actually showing the expression of love in a mutual relationship? So that's first. And that, by the way, has utterly outside of a notion of narrative or dogma. And that's a very straightforward, it's experience. It's in the lived experience. So first it shows up in lived experience, which is beautiful because that is, by definition, non-doctrinal. And is hyper-specific. The way you love your daughter in this moment, right, is what it is. And the way you love your daughter in the next moment and the way you love, your brother are different, right? Deeply different. They have to be specific, right? Hyper-specific, very particular. And yet they're also both love, right? And neither can be really proscribed by any finite state of words. I can't tell you a story that tells you how to do that. Does that make sense what I'm saying there? Like, that's the difference.
Yeah, well, I'm again, because I have Illich on my mind so much, he talks about the Samaritan And the fact that you choose to pick the Samaritan out of the ditch, you ignore the tribal customs, you ignore the dogma of the day. You might even be disgusted by this person. But it's not the same thing as sort of charity. It's a choice, a very unique choice you make in that moment to lift the guy out of the ditch, to embrace the stranger. And it can't be institutionalized. This was his big point.
Exactly. It can't be institutionalized, and it also can't be internalized as your own. You can't figure out on the basis of your own mental models either, right?
So
you
can't institutionalize it great yourself. Point, yeah.
You can't institutionalize it in community, right? It comes through this transcendent to immanent flow. Okay, well, that has the real serious advantage of being able to be truly universalized because it is hyper-localized. And so this cosmo-localism is a really nice term. Honestly, I like it better than Sivium. So feel free to use that. Like that's just as good. And it's, I think, pointed to more or less the same thing. So I have 0% attached to the, as you can imagine, to the institutionalization of a particular terminology, and I have no trademarks. But this notion of transcendent or universal by nature and hyper-local or particular by nature, I think is the core, right? That's the centerpiece.
Yep.
And then what happens is we start getting out to the place and, okay. Yeah, sure. I think I can probably share this. So my my cousin comes from a very religious, Christian religious family. And her husband does as well. And what I discovered recently, because I've become capable of even noticing, like knowing what these things mean, she was raised Protestant. She has actually been, I think it's called charismatized or entered into the Orthodox. Yeah. Right? I don't know how to pronounce it. Her husband's Pentecostal. And I now know enough to know that's a little bit of a joke. Like, wow. So, you know, Orthodoxy is over here and Pentecostal is over here in terms of where they fit in the kind of the Christian denominations. But their marriage works. Interesting, right? Well, because they're ultimately recognized that they're each deeply committed to the same faith. And they can deal with the fact that the particulars are particulars that they're going to deal with in this life. Not the particulars, but kind of like the formalisms. And so she goes to his church and she's like, wow, these guys are off the wall crazy. He goes to her church and she's like, these guys are, you know, very committed to things that I may, in fact be heresy.
But they love each other anyway. Yeah.
But they love each other anyway, right?
Yeah.
And in fact,
I would say that's kind of the nature of love, isn't it? There's always a huge difference between you and your partner. So there has to be a big difference, you know.
Otherwise, it's very. In fact, if there's zero difference, then it's just you, and that's not what you're like. That's an abomination. But in fact, if you can actually love somebody who's very different from you, then that's extremely powerful, like extremely interesting. And so, you know, if I use that as an example, but if I imagine these, let's say, villages, these Sivium, you know, colons at different levels of scale, you then get to actually be able to say, well, you know, here's how we create the ritual and logistic structure that supports a level of devotion and actualization of right life. And here's how you do it. And you actually do it slightly differently than us. And it's interesting. I can see how that approach might actually be better than our approach, or I can see how that approach would be worse, or I can see how that approach would work in these contexts. And by the way, I don't want to at all like trivialize this very powerful and challenging strata in between.
Yeah, well,
something like
the boundaries are there for a reason as well. I would say, I mean,
yeah,
in some sense,
yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. I think the notion of heresy is a perfectly valid notion, and I think it's problem. Right? There's particularly, you know, people can be very confused. And it's easy to convince in the con man sense by saying things. And any valid religion has to be hermetically sealed. Hermes being the fun thing that popped in my head right there against that kind of problem. And of course, it's exactly the same way that we can say that institutions have natural characteristics that we can be aware of. Well, human beings have natural characteristics, and human beings try to jack social systems by conning other people.
Yeah.
So
well, I think of it as a kind of alchemical chamber is a religion has a certain kind of alchemic, each religion has its own alchemy of sorts, and there has to be either there's you know you could, it could be very creative, but the elements have to be, you know, in the right place, or otherwise if you try to mix too many things together, then people get kind of confused and lost, and they try to invent their own their own religion, then everybody ends up with a religion of their own, and that doesn't work either.
It doesn't work at all, like 0%.
Doesn't work, no.
The way that I've really been thinking about it, and this is all very mushy, it's just me thinking about it, is the metaphor is the body, the human body, where the heart does not try to convince the lungs to be a heart. And the heart needs the lungs to be lungs, because they're all part of the same body. And the body has a particular way of allowing differentiation into proper difference and integration into well-integrated wholeness. And so you need both. Yeah. And I think if you can imagine the category of religion in that way, you say, okay, this difference over here is a proper difference that actually gives rise to a capacity that the integrated wholeness actually needs. Then you can actually have a beautiful, like, that's different than us. And I honor that difference because it's a valid, useful difference that I don't want to be participating in. That's not mine. Like I wouldn't be able to be functional in that space because I'm a lung, not a heart. That's a metaphor that I've definitely been playing with. I don't know if it really works, but it works at least in human bodies.
I think a living body is a good way to think about a religious congregation, or makes sense to me, or because everything is in relationship to everything else, you know, there's nothing outside the relationations.
It's unavoidable in a deep sense. Like, mm-hmm. like just to say a given church, you know, the congregation. One, I noticed that at least in the Christian lineage, the language of body is commonplace, right? The body of the church, the body of Christ. Christ is the head of the body of the church, that kind of stuff. But the individual human beings that are in that congregation are different from each other. And so at some point, they're going to have differences, right? They're going to think different things about reality, and they have different particular values and different ways of relating to the same values.
Yeah.
So you're not going to avoid that. So the challenge is how to incorporate that in the proper way so that it's a proper difference that produces something that is of distinct, real distinctness and real value in the context of a well-integrated one.
Yeah, well, I think that the interesting thing about, let's say, a temple or a congregation or a sangha or whatever you want to call it, is that everybody, there's a commonality, but there's a great difference as well. It's not like you're just hanging around your peer group or people who have the same beliefs, things, you know, people who are like you. Like, yeah. One of the problems, I guess, with modernity is we tend to cling to people who are just kind of like our type of person. Yep. And we get stuck in these ghettos, whereas a congregation has to be something. There's something universal about that. Like, there's always a crazy guy who's a bit schizophrenic in the congregation, and there's a scholar, and then there's a working active. And there has to be the whole panoply of humanity in there. Yeah,
exactly. And so I think there's a little bit of a. Kind of a holonic resonance that as it is in your local congregation is its own kind of individual in a larger congregation. Mm-hmm. And there's, I can say the topologically that kind of thing does scale up and down. I don't know practically what that exactly looks like. So I think maybe we've reached the end of this line. We could open up a whole new one, but it feels like...
Well, maybe I'll ask you sort of like, we have a few more minutes. Maybe you can speak on what are you up to? What are you, you know, what are your projects? What are you working towards
Primarily, I'm settling into this place. We've only been here 6 months and mm-hmm. we'll a little over that. And this is definitely where I'm most interested in all kinds of ways, like interested in the sense of, they say that, was it the, when it comes to breakfast, the chicken is, that's not true. The chicken is interested and the pig is invested. So I guess I'm invested in this place. Mm-hmm. My child will be raised here. I certainly hope that my great grandchildren will be raised here. Right? That's the way I'm approaching it. So most of my energy is just going into being here and meeting the people and learning how that I can participate properly with the place and the people in the place. Secondarily, because it actually is like really holding my family well, I have had more attention available to doing things like writing. And yeah, I think I might write a few things. I might even write more than a few things. It's hard to say.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's interesting. Because I've heard you say a few times that you don't want to write. And I've always found that to be a pity, even though I kind of understand it. And I wonder if we're moving towards kind of more oral culture than books, and that most ideas are produced like your recent article. But I also think there's something about the book that is kind of one of those eternal things that's not like Substack.
I tend to agree. I mean, I think I'm reasonably confident that we are moving back to a new kind of something, quasi-oral culture. And I think this will mean the attenuation of literacy in a very significant way. But I do not believe this will be the end of the book. I think the book has a role to play, but it'll be more like, I don't want to say the horse in the contemporary environment, but more like, what's a good example? I can't come up on the top of my head right now. It has a role to play. It is a unique thing, and it contains certain, particularly the fact that it's such a big investment on both sides of the equation. And that's a very powerful thing. But what I mean is that to write a book is a lot of work.
Yeah, no kidding.
To read a book is a lot of work. And so it's not throwaway. Like if you've chosen to spend, I don't know, days or weeks, or in some cases years, working through what's in a book, that changes you. Like it really helps move from the propositional to the participatory. And it involves you in a way that more surface level texts can't. And in a way that oral, like watching a video, can't. It's not the same as a real, like a significant relationship, but it's closer to that than it is to the other ones.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially for books that kind of endure. But, you know, I teach undergraduate courses in Paris, you know, you talk about the blue church and the red religion. And I was thinking about, like, this was one of your essays, which I guess that vocabulary entered the vernacular of all the people we know somehow.
And so I
try to sneak your some of your ideas into my classes, and some of your essays, they're not official, they're not part of any academic program, they're just good, stuff you good. Put
they're,
out
they're
there.
They're designed to be deeply, deeply unofficial.
But they're like Trojan horses or something, in the academic world, and I've noticed that students, you know, at a certain age, kind of respond to them. Young people respond to these ideas because they're very clearly written, but they're also, you know, I think there's a lot of life behind them, or a lot of intense, serious thinking behind them.
Thank you.
Anyway, yeah. I don't mean to be like flattering, but I when I saw your article come out today, I was like, oh, it's another one to play with that will probably have some influence in some way.
Well, in fact, I can definitely say this: if and when it becomes the case that writing is back to being a chore, or where I feel I've moved out of my blue period, and that, you know, I have 0% interest in writing for the purpose of having an audience or having people, you know, whatever, give me likes. Yeah. So if the ideas are not flowing in a way that feels like they have to be written, then I won't be writing them.
But right, right.
There's a few that are knocking at the door. So we'll see about that. And then the last thing that's there is that I'm considering moving also again into a CEO position. I guess is it formally? It is actually a CEO position in what would be a major transmedia initiative. And I'm not going to explain what that means, but it'd be the first time I've done anything like that in a long time. And I'm quite daunted by the amount of energy that's necessary to play that kind of a role. It's quite nice not to. But it's something that's been stewing in my world for more than a decade, and it may now be both ripe in its interior and ripe in terms of the kind of the window is there. So I'm spending a lot of time kind of doing due diligence and investigating that possibility. If it happens, then it'll happen, and that'll be where most of my time goes. If it doesn't happen, then that'll be that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, well, in a way, there's a connection to Illich too, in how you approach these things, because he was very much like, he was very famous at one point, and then he kind of gave it all up because he was only responding, I think, to the spirit. he wasn't responding to anything else, and the suffering he saw, or the potential or that he saw. So hopefully we can all do that more. And
yeah, that was such a funny one, right? So I would say is that I deeply endorse those values, and then I try to live that way.
Yeah, which is, I guess, the best we can do. Yeah. As sinners, another thing you said, which you meant, you said at one of your podcasts, which I was also thinking about. Is that you said that you sin at least 56 times a day, and then there's micro sins. So I thought, yes. Even because you seem to be a very competent person. So I was like, I'm wondering how does Jordan sin?
I mean, all the different ways the humans sin.
yeah, I know. You don't have to answer that question. I'm just fooling around.
I could say the ones that I would consider to be like more intense. They have the kind of stuff that I've never participated in the Catholic environment, but so I'm entirely making this up. But the kind of stuff where I would imagine, you know, the priest would give you a lot of stuff you have to do to atone for that sin.
Yeah.
Those are mostly in the review mirror. You know, I've had a pretty sizable introduction to or participation in many of the kind of various sins of the humanity is capable of. I've not killed anybody.
Okay.
absent that, yeah, I've participated in most of them. A combination of just being older and wiser, but also a much deeper orientation towards, well, I guess, metanoia, like repentance, and engaging in the variety of sort of proper practices that help actually atone. Mm-hmm. And then taking that sort of thing seriously has reduced my sins to being less intense for the most part. what was the phrase? But still, you know, all the time. And I think what I noticed, at least in my experience, is something like, if you would say like I'll put it in my point of view. As you become more capable of living in a more wholesome way,
yeah,
you also are more sensitive.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah,
it's kind of like a Red Queen's race, but I don't. It's not that kind of thing. It's different, and I don't think that's bad. I think that's good. I think that just allows you to recognize that this is an infinite process, but that you're also, it's a process, like you're moving. So I feel like I actually feel particularly here, like now I'm with so much more support and so much more, what do you call it? Like actual religion. Like I'm not making it up. I don't have to figure it out myself. I can actually tap into something that people already do and understand. A lot of it's easier and it's more lived. And I should say, by the way, I'm practicing this for real. Like this is not a thing that I'm just thinking about or even like once a week. Vanessa and I, just my wife, we actually kicked off a fasting practice. Mm-hmm. So we're fasting now once a week, and we may actually kick it up to 2 days a week for all the reasons that people know and have kind of woven into, you know, every sort of religion that's ever existed. So we're limping our way back into things that have been part of cultures for a long time.
Yeah, that's the way, it seems to me anyway.